Thanks for downloading from the BBC. To find other downloads or more information, go to bbc.co.uk/5live.
This is 5 Live at 3:04. Mark Kermode, good afternoon to you.
Good afternoon. It's nice and cool, isn't it?
It is. It is nice and cool. It's a bit cooler outside as well.
Yes, it's lovely.
And what movies are we looking at today?
Cars. Or I think, is it officially called Pixar's Cars?
No, it's not really.
But Cars. Stay Alive, a new film based around computer games, although this time not necessarily based on a single computer game. And it's one of those titles that kind of, you know, just invokes puns. Renaissance, which is a strange animation thing. And the new Luc Besson movie, Angel A, or Angela, as it keeps getting called. But I think there's a pun there as well.
All those to come, and we'll give you the box office top 10 and your contributions, of course, to assorted dialogues which have been going on over the previous weeks. Mayo at bbc.co.uk, 85058. Now, we've also been joined by Claire Hope Asherty, who's one of the stars of Shooting Dogs, which is out on DVD this week. Hello, Claire.
Hi.
How are you?
I'm very well, thank you.
Now, I remember from when Hugh Dancy was in.
The very nice Hugh Dancy.
Very, very nice.
Very nice. Claire, I'm not saying she's not, but I'm just saying that even though he was
very Claire nice. Is in a position to tell us how nice he is.
Yeah, he's nice. He's okay. He's a good guy.
Only okay. See, if you work with Hugh Dancy, I bet he's an absolute pig.
But that's like, you know, when you asked Anthony Horowitz what he thought of Mickey Rourke, he just said, I think we've run out of time. So actually, that was a stunning, endorsement.
So what was it like working with John Hurt?
Great. He's such a great guy.
So far more enthusiastic about John Hurt.
Well, no, they're both. Everyone was great, you know. It's otherwise I start gushing if I start going on too much. But John was really great. I mean, he's very enthusiastic. He's fantastic to be around because he has so many stories to tell from his years and years in the business. And he's just incredibly professional, but a lot of fun at the same time, which is a fantastic combination.
Mm. And Hugh Dancy, what's he like then?
Hugh Dancy is also great, equally as great and equally as nice.
Now, the Rwandan genocide is a difficult subject to film. Hotel Rwanda was obviously had an amazing impact on everyone who saw it. And I think we talked about it at the time, because it only had a 12 certificate. Meant that although the subject matter was 18, it actually got the story out to a whole number of people.
It did, yeah.
How did you approach filming this unbelievably terrible story? And how did you fit in? Just tell us how you fit in the story.
Well, the character that I played was a 14-year-old Tutsi girl who was living in Rwanda at the time and kind of got caught up in all of the violence and is in this... Well, it's kind of based in a school and she's in this school as a refugee camp in Kigali, the capital of Rwanda, whilst all the violence is taking place.
And how does your 14-year-old schoolgirl fit in with the... Because John Hurt is the priest, and he's assisted by the very nice and very lovely, very gorgeous Hugh Dancy, who's very nice to work with. And so where do you fit in the...
She's a pupil at the school, and she has very strong bonds with both John Hurt's character, the priest, and Hugh Dancy's character, the teacher. She's sort of a teacher's pet, and I think she quite fancies him as well.
And the... During the filming of it, I mean, he was, just to refer back to the interview, he was telling us that a lot of the people who were involved in the film were actually there or knew people involved with the Rwandan genocide, and it was all part of their story.
Oh, yes, absolutely. Tons of the people that we worked with had been in Rwanda during the genocide. A lot of the people, a lot of the extras especially, who came from the surrounding area of the school had been in the school when that particular story happened, or definitely new people. I mean, everyone that we met had been touched in some way by the genocide.
And of course, it's worth saying that you filmed on the location, in Kigali, where all these events took place. So there's a terrible sense of authenticity about it.
Yeah.
All.
But recreating a crime against humanity in the place and using some of the people who were there at the time would have been extremely upsetting for those involved.
Absolutely. I think you can't get away from that fact. But at the same time, this is a reality that they live with every day. And it's not like we came in there and we were just bringing it all back up. It's something that they've lived with since the genocide and they continue to live with. And that is part of who they are and of who they're going to be. And so in that sense, although it must have been upsetting, I think in a way it was also quite cathartic.
It is worth saying that on the DVD, which is coming out, which I've watched all the extras of course you feature in the extras being interviewed there, director Michael Caton-Jones, who amazingly, back-to-back made Basic Instinct 2, which was released on the same day. I mean, yeah. Shooting Dogs and Basic Instinct 2 on the same
day. He dances in both.
He is, yeah. That is a CV. But there's an awful lot of behind-the-scenes footage about going out to the location, because, of course, David Belton, who's the producer, was a BBC journalist and knew the area very much. And Michael Caton-Jones talks very, very informatively about understanding exactly the responsibilities of filming in this area, having trauma counsellors on hand. And there were some media stories at the time said, you know, how can they go and do this? So it sounded from all the stuff that he said and from other people that they were very, very clear of the responsibilities involved. And of course, somebody was quoted as having said, you know, I'm sorry, the problem is not movies about this. The problem is people not knowing this story. And it did seem to be a general feeling that people wanted the story to be told, even people who had lived through those terrible events.
Definitely. They were very keen for their story to be told. And I think it wouldn't have felt right shooting in any other place than where it happened with the people who've been involved, because it's their story and they have every right to be involved and to tell the story the way they want it. And that, you know, their participation in the process was huge, because that's the way that Michael and David, you know, both wanted it. And they have so much respect for these people and what they went through that they thought, there's no way that we can do this, you know, with any kind of authenticity without going to the people that this happened to and being in the place where it happened.
You were making, of course, in one sense, just another film, but is it one of those films which will, however many more films you go on to make, will it stay with you and the people that you met stay with you?
Absolutely. Just despite what I go on to do, whether I go on to make films or do whatever, because I'm going to university in September, it will always stay with me, not just because it was my first movie, but it was such an immersive experience, and I went through so much and I changed in so many ways and met so many amazing people. It's a kind of experience that has a stamp and an impact on your life and that will always be there no matter what you do.
So were you in your gap year then?
I was between lower and upper sixth.
How did you get the job?
Well, I've had an agent.
She knew Hugh Dancy, you know, that was it.
He's nice.
He put in a good word.
Not quite. I don't know, that's the first time I met him, actually. Okay. I hadn't really heard of him before. He's very nice, though.
He's quite nice to work with, apparently.
I'd had an agent for quite a while, and I'd been going to drama school on Saturdays. And then she just sent me off to this audition, you know, purely by chance, and I just went through that process with it.
Are you in contact still with any of the people that you met?
Yeah, quite a few of them by email. We went back there early this year for the screening, and it was just great to catch up with everyone and see what they've been doing. So, kind of email contact and a couple of phone calls, which is nice.
I did mention this when the aforementioned Mr. D came in, because you might as well be honest about these. I watched most of the film, and I just... So I didn't know, though Mark has told me since, how the final section of the story of the massacre itself is carried out. I just thought, I just don't think I want to watch the last bit. So I watched everything up to, and I just thought, I'm just not sure I want to watch this, you know, last thing before we go to bed and have these images of slaughter. But it is done, Mark, if such a thing is possible, with enormous sensitivity.
It's done with enormous sensitivity. And, of course, what's happening as well in the character that John Hurt plays, the Father Christopher character, is that as this terrible thing is unfolding, he comes to a realisation of what it means for him to be devoted to those people. And at the same time as this absolutely, I mean, unspeakable horror is about to unfold, there is, in the middle of it, a sense of something more, of some kind of spirituality. It doesn't just leave you with a sense of, you know, everything is terrible. It does look beyond that. But I have to say, and I really like the film. I really like Michael Caton-Jones as a director. I think he's really underrated. I think it's emotionally harrowing, and in the best possible sense it is. And I also think it's a credit to the film that you get that far into it and you think, I don't want to watch it, because what that proves is it's not just becoming a work of entertainment. It's not exploitative. It is like watching, you know, an account of a real event with all the fictionalizations, because obviously his character, Father Christopher's character, is fictionalized to some extent. The Hugh Dancy character is fictionalized to some extent. It's, you know, it is very, very powerful. It's a really strong piece of work, but it's not exploitative.
The extras on the DVD, which you've watched then, I'm quite amazed at your commitment to this.
Well, I like the film and I like Michael Caton-Jones very much, particularly because of that. And as you know, I'm a huge fan of Basic Instinct 2. And it's very interesting seeing the on-set interview with yourself. And at one point you say, well, you know, I really don't know much about this, but I'm finding out everything every day. And I thought the most interesting thing about it was actually an awful lot of people don't know much about it. I never knew anything about these events until I started finding out about them from movies. And there are occasionally times when you think, you know, cinema is plugging a gap here in the popular knowledge. I mean, I have, you know, no great political awareness anyway. anyway, as you probably know.
But most people might have just read about it or seen it on the TV, maybe.
No, I know, but most people, I mean, actually before Hotel Rwanda, I think most people didn't have any sense of it in the way that they did when Hotel Rwanda came out, because I mean, we discussed this when Hotel Rwanda came out. How did something that appalling happen whilst the world looked away? And of course, actually, the most distressing thing in Shooting Dogs is the sight of the UN leaving.
Absolutely.
You know.
So, Claire, people would have spotted the fact you say that you're about to go to university. So,
yeah.
Are you not off on a, you know, acting all over the place and turning up in movies? Have you got time to study academics?
I don't know. It's a bit crazy at the moment, because I was always certain that I wanted to go to university, and then I did Shooting Dogs, and for a while I was still certain, and then I thought, oh, actually, you know, maybe I quite like this, and then I did another movie just at the beginning of this year, and I'm sort of on shaky ground at the moment. I still want to go to university and I still really want to study, but I'm unsure what I want to do with my life when I grow up.
So the experience of making this movie is not one that you would necessarily think, right, I know what I'm going to do for the rest of my time.
No, I think it was so different to most other movie making experiences, certainly from the one I've just had. It was just more of a life experience, and it had so little to do with making entertainment and was just making a movie that it didn't really seem like a job at the time. It just seemed like this thing that we were all going through. And you know, also because I'd been so set on becoming a lawyer for such a long time that I had my plan. I thought, this is, you know, I'm doing this on the side, but I'm still on my path. But now I'm kind of unsure.
Once you've got your legal degree, then you'll be absolutely shoo-in for all the next John Grisham movies. So, I mean, absolutely. Top actress with a degree in law.
But John Grisham movies don't bear any relationships. I mean, it'd be very good, because you'd be able to know how it is, the ways in which the movie companies are taking you for a ride if you have a legal degree. Sean Connery was once asked, I think it was at the Edinburgh Festival, somebody said, look, I'm an aspiring young actor. What advice would you give me? And he said, get a very good lawyer. And everyone laughed. And he said, no, I'm being serious. Get a very good lawyer. So you could be both.
Absolutely. So you can be involved with movies and use that law degree that you're getting.
Well, we'll see what happens.
Claire, appreciate you coming in. Thanks very much indeed.
Say hi to Hugh Dancy for us.
I will indeed.
What's he like then?
He's nice. He's a nice guy.
Just thought we'd just
ask. He's nicer than Mickey Rourke.
Shooting Dogs is out on DVD. Claire Hope Ashty, thanks very much indeed.
Thank you.
So 316 will... oh, hang on. There's just some text coming in. There's some correspondence just before you go. This says, this had better be good because I haven't checked it out.
Okay.
I want to say hi to the lovely Claire. Tell her that Steve Toussaint says that Arsenal will trounce her poxy northern team.
Ah, Steve. Arsenal are rubbish. Manchester United rule.
Oh dear, what a depressing end to that to that conversation. I like the first half of what you said, just the second bit that was slightly tasteless. Anyway, Claire, still very nice to have you on the programme. Thanks very much indeed.
Thank you for having me.
We'll get to the box office top 10 and some of your correspondence in a bit. First of all, while we're talking movies, Penny Woolcock joins us, British filmmaker. A new film out later this year is Mischief Night. This weekend she takes part in the Brit Doc Festival in Oxford. Hello.
Hello.
So we're now Brit Doc. I imagine that'll be full of British documentaries then.
Well, I think it is mainly about British documentaries, and it's really to showcase the amazing kind of talent that there is in this country, because the world is such an interesting and terrifying and hilarious place that people who go out and make films about it often bring back stories that are really fascinating.
What is the state of British documentary making?
Well, in some ways, I think a lot of people are very depressed about the fact that they've more or less disappeared. Serious documentaries have more or less vanished from mainstream television. But they're definitely still there on More4 and on BBC 4 as well. But those series that we used to have, you know, Cutting Edge and Fine Cut and all of that, they've really been replaced by format television, by Big Brother and that kind of thing, which aren't really proper documentaries. But on the other hand, you know, there's always a way, and just as things begin to die on their feet, they pop up somewhere else. So I don't feel discouraged at all.
Do most of I just thinking about the documentaries that you might go to the movies to see,
yeah.
Most of the ones would have caught the attention, would have come from the States, so whether it be Michael Moore or Super Size Me or the Al Gore movie, those kind of things. What are you saying, Mark?
Exactly. And that's partly because in America they haven't really ever had that space on television. So filmmakers who are really passionate about making a documentary have had to raise the money and go out and make these films and then sell them. Whereas here I think we've maybe become a little bit comfortable. You know, we've been used to having our films commissioned, and then I think people are in shock when that didn't happen. But I think there's a whole new generation that will be working much more in that American way, and we'll see these very individual, original, passionate films coming out from that. So something good might come out of the fact that TV is chasing ratings and chasing out documentary.
So what do we get at the Brit Doc Festival? And can anyone take part? Can we all join in and come in and watch?
Well, anybody can come, and there are sessions with documentary filmmakers and lots of kind of brilliant films on show. I've literally just got off the train myself, so I haven't seen anything yet. But it was the brainchild of Jess Search, who used to commission very individual documentaries at Channel 4. And I think she was thinking that it would be great to have something that wasn't so dependent on television and that was really searching for a much wider audience and looking at different ways of people coming to see films. And that it shouldn't just be the Americans, because after all, documentary was actually born in this country, and this is where we have the really strong tradition and the training for it.
Mark, what do you think about going to the movies to see documentaries? I mean, it's a specialist audience, isn't it?
Well, it's interesting because, I mean, about, I suppose, 10 years ago, there simply was not that great plethora of documentaries in the cinema. You had things occasionally like Hearts and Minds, you know, big documentaries. But, and it is largely in the wake of Michael Moore, of whom I'm not a huge fan, as you know, and, of course, you know, Nick Broomfield, about whom I have reservations.
Also not a fan.
Not a fan, but, you know, let's move swiftly on. But what they did was they proved that there was a market, a box office market for those films. And since then, I mean, just recently, like in the last year, you know, Enron, Smartest Guys in the Room, Walmart, the high cost of low price, as you say, the Al Gore documentary, which went down very well in Cannes. I mean, people have just got used to the idea, again, of being able to see documentaries in the cinema. And an awful lot of it was just to do with public perception. At the beginning of the Michael Moore thing, when he was doing things like Roger and Me, people say, oh, you know, documentaries in the cinema, what's the point of that? Now, as a result of the great wave of American documentaries, they have got used to it. And I think that means that people are now much more willing to do that, which is very good, because an awful lot of good documentary filmmaking gets made for theatrical distribution. And it's just good that the people's perception is now, well, you know, we could go and see a drama, we could go and see a documentary, in the same way as you could go and see animation, you could go and see a live action. The more that people want difference from what they get from the cinema, the more they don't want to go and see Pirates of the Dratted Caribbean, the better, frankly.
It's possible to enjoy Parents.
Parents of the Caribbean.
Parents of the
Caribbean.
That's
number five, right?
that's a whole new spin-off.
Yeah, yeah.
So, Penny, what are you going to... What do you think is the highlight of the Brit Doc Festival?
I'm afraid I'm in the middle of pre-production on another film, so
here's an easier question.
What
are you contributing to the Brit Doc Festival?
Well, there's a session about filmmakers, including Nick Broomfield, actually, and Mike Figgis.
Say hi to him,
send our love.
And Pavel Palikowski and myself, who are people who come from a documentary background and have moved into fiction. And I think it's just talking about what kind of things we might bring to fiction that we've learned from our documentary work. So that's what the session's about.
Penny, good to talk to you. Thank you very much indeed. Wish you all the best for that. It's 3:25. Many emails on many different topics, but the box office top 10 would seem to take top precedence, as we have done it here. Golmaal at 10, which you probably still haven't seen because they haven't arranged distribution.
No, although the BBC website says that it's got far too much stuff going on. It's a sort of a ribald comedy, but there's far too many things going on in it. But then again, there are several of those movies from that particular genre in which you could say there is far too much going on, because they generally tend to be very long and have, you know, a bit of everything. So, but apparently it's not great.
Just My Luck at 9.
Lindsay Lohan finally leaving the top 10. She tried her hardest. She did better than I'd expected. Are McFly still together? Have they split up as a result of
I think they're
still going. Yeah. So, fine. Hey, I was wrong. What do I know?
Little Fish at 8.
It's a great performance by Cate Blanchett, and it's a very arty, interesting film which is trying to do something new and original. I'm not sure that it's quite the masterpiece that perhaps the Australian critics think it is, and it's certainly been up for a number of Australian awards, and people have been talking about it in terms of Oscar nominations, but Cate Blanchett is really very good as a recovering drug addict.
Marx's History then at 7, The Wind That Shakes the Barley.
Yeah, I like it, and I think you should go and see it, you should go and discuss the issues afterwards, and I saw Ken Loach in the street the other day, and I said hello to him and he said hello back, so that's fine.
That really.
So we're obviously still on talking terms.
As riveting anecdotes go, that's
thank you.
Hardly shakes.
Yeah, but he's telling people I saw that Mark Kermode in the street the other day.
Over the hedge at six.
Depressingly average. All the state-of-the-art CG graphic animation with famous celebrity voices doing not very much. And as I said, let's wait until 6 months' time and then somebody email in and tell me what the plot of Over the Hedge is. I guarantee you won't be able to remember it.
Garfield 2 at five.
It's awful. And it's so bad that I spent the first 10 minutes of it thinking that can't be Bill Murray. They've got somebody else to do Bill Murray's voice because it's not possible. Sorry, that's my stomach making that noise. It's not possible for a movie with Bill Murray's voice in it to be this poor, but it's absolutely dreadful.
It's noise coming from two different parts of the Kermode at the same time.
Sorry.
Stormbreakers at four.
I liked it. It's good fun. It's obviously, as we know, it has Mickey Rourke in it, about whom I'm still waiting for somebody to say a good word, but he is the villain in it. Somebody said, you know, we've got Mickey Rourke as the villain. Who more villainous than Mickey Rourke? And as you remember, Anthony Horowitz said, I think we've run out of time. But it's really good fun, and it's entertaining for the kids. It has a slightly rough and ready feel in the way of many English movies, which are quite like British movies, which are quite like. It's a fantastic advertisement for the Isle of Man. And we look forward to seeing what they'll manage to do with the next Stormbreaker, because, of course, there is the issue that your man in the lead role is now too old to play Alex Rider. After one movie.
Superman Returns at number three. Now, on that, Richard Mead says, saw Superman Returns last night. Despite being too long, the first hour very dull, I found myself enjoying it. However, I can't help thinking that all Superman was missing was a beard and sandals at various moments. And this from M. Morris. I'm afraid I'm having a slight crisis with Dr. Kermode's reviews of late. It was bad enough when he failed to mention all the things wrong with Superman Returns. Clunking Christian allegory, a plan by Lex Luthor which makes no sense at all, and the film continues for a good half hour after that when the actual story is finished. But then he says the breakup isn't terrible.
No, it's not.
The breakup is really terrible. It has a few chuckles in it, but it's so obviously a film commissioned and made by Hollywood executives who have no soul and understand demographics rather than people. There's lots more where that came from.
Well, look, about the breakup?
Let's do Superman first.
Okay, Superman, I like Superman. The religious allegory stuff I have no problem with. As you know, I'm a bit of a bore for all that stuff, and I like the moment when, you know, having lost all his power, he has to go up into the sky to get his power back from the sun, and he does the cruciform pose, and that's fine. I have never had any problem with it. And actually, I like Superman anyway. The saying that the plan by Lex Luthor doesn't make any sense, it's like, what? And all the other plans that Lex Luthor had made sense. You know, it's a plan to build a new island. I mean, of course it doesn't make sense. It's Superman.
And a man flying doesn't make
a
whole
flying
lot of
doesn't
sense.
Make it. Incidentally, and I mention this only in passing, in the original Superman cartoons, of course, the comic strip, Superman couldn't fly. It was because he was from a planet that had a lot of gravity. He was very strong, so he could jump. He could leap tall buildings at a single bound, but he couldn't fly. Superman flying was an aberration that happened later on in the Superman strip, and nobody has ever managed to explain why it is that if you come from the planet Krypton, which is very heavy, so you've got very strong muscles, that would make you able to defy the laws of gravity. You can't fly, you can jump. And very early on in this film, we see him actually levitating. He doesn't jump, he levitates off the floor. And I thought, well, that's very interesting, because what you're doing is you're throwing open the whole Superman flying debate. And as far as the breakup's concerned, every moment that Jennifer, what's her name, is on screen, rubbish. Every moment that Vince Vaughn is on screen, funny Vince Vaughn film. And it's not just, I mean, yes, it is a water cooler movie. Yes, I hate that poster because, as I said, it's one of those things, you know, pick a side, blah, blah, discussion, all that rest of that stuff. But Vince Vaughn originated the project. Vince Vaughn came up with the story. It's a Vince Vaughn project. Vince Vaughn has then gone to the studio and said, this is what I want to do. And they said, fine, as long as you do it with Jennifer Aniston. It's not good. But half of it is not bad.
M. Morris continues, I wondered when last I saw so many joyless, shallow, vapid characters on screen. Forget the pirate film that dare not speak its name. This really is the end of Western civilization.
Well, I think the last time I saw that many joyless, vapid characters was Closer, the Patrick Marber film with, you know, Julia Roberts in it. And I hate everyone in that film. I mean, I like Patrick Marber as a writer, but I just think everyone in that film was just putrescence made flesh.
That's very good.
Thank you.
Actually, the Daleks can fly now, so Superman can do what he wants, really, if the Daleks...
Yeah, but the Daleks can fly because they're electronic. There's probably some on switch, which is the gravito-defio switch. You know, that's it. That's always, you know, it's very good that we turned on the breathe-in-space function, but Superman doesn't have that. Incidentally, he also flies to Krypton at the beginning of the film from Earth. What, holding his breath?
The UK's number one film is Pirates. Tony Parrott says, went to see Pirates last week after really enjoying the first movie, thinking that Dr. Kermode was being very biased regarding how bad the second installment was and how stupid of me to doubt the revered Dr. Kermode. This is probably one of the worst films I've seen in recent years, and the revelation at the end of who's going to save Captain Jack. Anyway, lots of exclamation marks. I promise never to doubt the good doctor again. Lots more here. Victoria says, are there any pirate films Mark actually likes? Surely to complain that a pirate film is bitty, has an insipid hero and gurning anti-hero, is like complaining that vampire films are full of people with pointy teeth.
There must be good pirate films. I mean, the terrible thing is that before Pirates of the Caribbean, there's Cutthroat Island, which has gone down in history as, like, you know, one of the greatest cinematic disasters of all time, except for the fact that Matthew Modine made a short film on the set of Cutthroat Island, which is a short film with the most expensive set ever.
Nathan Birtle says, Simon and Mark, my son Hugo, age 9, listened with us to the podcast, the review for Pirates of the Caribbean. Mm. Wimbledon seems a long time ago,
doesn't
it?
It does, doesn't it?
Dead Man's Chest, on the journey up to stay with his grandparents for a week during school holiday. Having enjoyed the first film enormously, he was furious at Mark's review and commented that it is clear that we can never be friends.
Yes.
This is Hugo, age
9. Yeah.
Upon his return and having seen Dead Man's Chest whilst being away, he handed me this letter to pass on to Mark.
Oh, dear.
Dear Mr. Radio Guy, yeah, writes Hugo, age 9, uh-huh, I agree with you mostly about Pirates of the Caribbean, Dead Man's Chest, though I do not think it was the death of narrative cinema. It was the death of a good fairy story. There were too many parts in the film that made no sense, and there was no ending, only a to be continued. I still disagree with you when you say that Curse of the Black Pearl was a stuck-up film that made too much money. Love, Hugo. I think you have a new listener. Keep
did I say a stuck-up
work.
Film? I don't remember saying that. It's a very valid criticism. And, you know, there we go. If we have listeners at the age of 9 who have that level of understanding of what's wrong with the film, then I think we're you know, laughing, frankly.
Mark Kermode is here. A movie review coming up in just a moment. Steve on the M4, as Wolf Creek is on Film 4 for the first time.
Oh, is it?
Can the great Dr. Kermode please give me his valued view on this horror from Oz? Is it very scary
it's
or not?
Great. It's great. It's very, very disturbing. I saw it first thing in the morning in Cannes, not this year, last year. And I staggered out onto the street about 10 o'clock feeling I had really had my head bent out of shape by it. It's like Texas Chainsaw Massacre in its tone. And certainly the last third of it, you are sitting there thinking, I just have no
I've
idea where
such
this
a
is
mistake
going.
Coming in to watch
no,
this.
No, no, thinking how great to feel genuinely terrorised by a movie. And of course, we had the guy who may or may not be the villain, who was just a terrifically nice bloke, who apparently was in Neighbours before.
Something like that. Right, we need to do Cars, because it's a big movie with lots of posters.
Cars, the new movie by Pixar, directed by John Lasseter. You may know that there were stories in the press a while ago in June. Disney executives are reported as being really rather depressed by the performance of Cars at the box office, and wondering whether or not it was going to hit the 200 million. Of course, as far as I can tell, it's 230 million and still going. So, I mean, that's something to be really rather depressed about. It is astonishing what now constitutes a lackluster performance by a Pixar film. I mean, amounts of money that you can't even begin to imagine. So the story is, it's in a world which is populated entirely by cars, no people. You remember the thing recently with The Incredibles, which was this whole question about whether or not they could do just a people movie. Although The Incredibles, of course, were superheroes. In this case, just cars. Central car character, voiced by Owen Wilson, called Lightning McQueen, is a racing car. He's on his way to a race. Stuff happens. He ends up in Radiator Springs, which is a tiny little town, where for plot reasons, which are not that complicated, he is forced to stay for a while. And, as in the nature of Doc Hollywood or any of these stories, while staying in Radiator Springs, he learns some lessons in life, not least from Paul Newman, who voices Doc Hudson, as always, great old stars appearing as voiceover artists. It's absolutely lovely to look at. It has fantastic design, particularly if, like me, you're into 50s Americana, you're into that kind of the particular form of pastel shades, which you really don't get so much anymore. The landscapes alone are astonishing, because one of the things they decided very early on was that in the same way that people will see shapes that are familiar to people when they look at clouds, for example, they'll see things that they recognize. The idea was that in a car world, everything would look sort of car-like to cars. So as they're driving through this American desert, which looks like Nevada or Arizona, you see these rock formations that look like the rear end of a Ford, or look like, you know, the front end of a Dodge. And of course, the place that he's holed up in is called Radiator Springs. And from a design point of view, it's absolutely lovely. There has been some controversy about whether or not putting the car's eyes in the windshield rather than, you know, in the more traditional way of doing it in the headlights was a good idea. Some people think it's too cute for its own good. Actually, it didn't bother me in the slightest bit. So from a design point of view, I absolutely loved it. Now, inherent in that praise is a criticism, which is when you watch Pixar movies, the most extraordinary thing about them is they are brilliantly designed, brilliantly executed. John Lasseter was doing this kind of 3D CG animation. It was very, very cutting edge of it, even before Toy Story. And the thing I always said was, it's interesting, you never say that first. You never say, wow, it looked great. You say, what great characters, what great story, what great plot, what great jokes. In the case of Cars, it's probably the first time with a Pixar movie that the most important thing is the design. It doesn't have the kind of wacky jokes and humour that the movies have had previously. I mean, Toy Story is laugh out loud funny. If you've got kids and you've seen them watching Toy Story, I mean, it is just a laugh every 3 or 4 minutes. Plus, it's very emotionally engaging, particularly Toy Story 2, incidentally. In the case of Cars, I wonder what a very young audience would make of it. Because I sat there enraptured by the look of it, and I sat there really, really enjoying it on a visual level. But I was aware that what I wasn't getting was the quick-fire, rapid, you know, real gripping emotional involvement that I've had in other Pixar films. Now, obviously, I had a problem with The Incredibles. I thought The Incredibles was not going to play to a young audience, and I was spectacularly wrong about that. In the case of Cars, I like it very much because I like the design, because I like the look, because I like the visual aesthetic, and because I think there's something brave about attempting to do those characters without any people at all. I mean, it's a totally, it's an eco-non-friendly film to some extent because it's all about cars. There aren't any people whatsoever. But I am aware of the fact that when I think of it, I think of it as images. I think that there's an exhibition on at the moment. If you go down to the Science Museum, there's an exhibition of Pixar.
In London, is that?
In London, that yes. Would be. I live in Southampton, so, you know. So I went to London and I saw the exhibition. And these extraordinary oil paintings that they've done and pastels and drawings, everything for the backgrounds. And you really could spend a few hours there. But I think it is both the best and the worst thing about Cars. To say it looks absolutely lovely, and particularly if, like me, you have a fondness for that look, it's absolutely ravishing. And yet, it doesn't have the characters, it doesn't have the gags, it doesn't have the absolute quote-a-minute thing that Pixar's movie have had in the past. It's a much slower and longer-feeling film than the other Pixar films. And I suspect that despite the cute eyes, it plays older than Cars. But I would say, even as I say that, I was very wrong about The Incredibles. I just didn't think that a young audience would sit through that first 20 minutes of Mr. Incredibles working in an insurance office and having a bad time. But apparently they do. But my own feeling about it was, it's visual first, and I love the visuals, but that's, you know, that is what it is.
RT on this email says, saw Cars 2. Oh, no,
sorry. Saw Cars 2? Send the piracy police round, I believe. I'm sorry.
I saw Cars 2 weeks ago at a special screening at the NFT. I was totally impressed. Mm. No death of narrative cinema here. Is this the best Owen Wilson film around? I'm pretty sure it is, says RT.
It does have a story. It is. I mean, that is true. It does have a narrative.
This film, most impressed because of the fact that both the kids and the adults were laughing. There were groups of parents and kids, as well as a few couples, and everyone talked about how good it was when we walked out. Compared to Ice Age 2 and other animation films, this is very impressive how Pixar have managed to make the audience empathise with a Porsche. I've got no idea, but it was very, very good indeed.
Well, that's very encouraging. And absolutely, it has a story, unlike Ice Age 2. It has some kind of development, unlike Ice Age 2. I mean, it's in a different league to Ice Age 2. It's a proper film. I mean, I think it is a very respectable, proper film.
Derek Edmund in Edinburgh says, I saw Cars first and for free. Thanks for that. Details on the new first and for free in just a moment. I need to say that I've not seen a lot of the most recent Pixar films, but I was disappointed. For a start, it's too long, not something
it
I usually
long.
Complain about, value for money and all that. But kids in the cinema were getting restless, and that was a screening without the usual 30 minutes of adverts and trailers beforehand. Lots and lots of jokes are crowbarred in. Blah, 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 blah. It's not like Toy Story because where the story always gets moved on and the creative little in-jokes decorate the story because they don't gel but have to be shown, the film is too long. It was funny, but the quality of the graphics have moved on hugely since Toy Story 2, but it didn't leave me with that feeling I got when I went to either of the Toy Stories or Shreks.
No, I agree. And it's 116 minutes. I mean, that's pushing 2 hours. That is long.
He says, thanks for the free tickets. My girlfriend thought it was brilliant, however. The current first in for free is Miami Vice, giving you the chance to see one of this summer's hit movies, I imagine. Might be a complete turkey, I imagine. Have you?
Yeah, but that doesn't mean it's going to be a hit.
No, I'll just say it says here, it's a surefire hit.
Yeah, well, it will be, I mean, you know.
Okay, anyway, listen, it's a hit, but we've only got seats if you live in Swansea, okay? Stars Colin Farrell and Jamie Foxx. All the tickets are gone apart from Swansea.
Swansea.
So if you're in the Swansea area or you're prepared to drive for a very long way, then you can see it on Wednesday, the 2nd of August, 08700 100 500, and you ask for option 4. You can take a look at the Five Live website. Stars, of course, Colin Farrell and Jamie Foxx as detectives Crockett and Tubbs. You know, many years ago, in 86, the first show I did for Radio 1 was Saturday Night, and I'm a pale white man. The guy who came on after me was Dixie Peach, who was a black guy.
Yeah.
Radio 1 seriously thought about marketing us as the Crockett and Tubbs of Radio 1. I kind of thought it wasn't a very good idea.
Did you wear no socks and loafers?
That absolutely.
Very good.
Still.
Okay. Very good.
What else is new?
Well, very quick before we do Stay Alive, I want to do The Protector because I want to mention this because it's one of the films I've really, really enjoyed this week. It's by the director of Ong Bak and also with the star Tony Jaa, who is this martial arts star from Thailand. Okay. The plot is Tony Jaa has his elephant stolen and he has to go to Australia to get it back.
Obviously.
It's a father elephant and a baby elephant. And in order to get it back, he has to go around Australia and has to beat a whole bunch of people up. One of the trivial things about this film is that it's one of the very few times in which an elephant has gone over a particular bridge in Sydney. In fact, I think it's the first time ever an elephant walked on Sydney Harbour Bridge. So there we go. But the most important thing about it is Tony Jaa is an incredible martial artist. If you're somebody who's a fan of Jackie Chan, who incidentally has a tiny little cameo, and you liked Ong Bak, which I did very much. I mean, Ong Bak was one of those great, you know, it's not why, it's not special effects, it's not CG, it's people beating each other up, but very, very balletically. So, in the case of Warrior King, which is just, did I call it The Protector before? Warrior King, the original title was The Protector.
No, it was Warrior King.
Warrior King, fine. Okay, the original title was The Protector, it's now called Warrior King. There is one fantastic moment in which there is a fight sequence that takes place over four different stories of a building, and it's all done in one single Steadicam shot, and it seems to go on for like forever. It's probably 5 minutes, but it's in. And during the course of him walking up these stairs and along these balconies, he just beats up hundreds of people, hundreds and hundreds of people falling off balconies, people falling into cakes, people going through doors, people going through windows, people going over their heads, hundreds of people. And then he gets to the top and shouts, "Where is my elephant?" And whenever he walks into a room, he'll jump in and loads of people will fall over and he'll shout, "Where is my elephant?" And it's, I mean, it's mind-bendingly fun. It was one of those really weird things.
Where is his elephant?
Oh, his elephant's been stolen.
Yeah, but where is it?
I can't tell you because that's the end. When he finds the elephant, and incidentally, the ending is not entirely happy. There's an element of happiness in it. But
where's my dead elephant?
There's two elephants. There's two. There's the baby elephant. There's the baby elephant. There's the daddy elephant. He really wants his elephants back, and he is willing to beat up a lot of people to get his elephants back. As I said, in this marvelous Steadicam shot. But
when he gets there, they're both dead.
I didn't say that. Did I say that?
You're implying.
No, I didn't imply it. I said that it's not an entirely happy ending. I mean, it has an eco.
One of them slightly poorly.
It has an eco-friendly message, which is don't steal elephants. And incidentally, could they, you know, be allowed to run around in their natural environment rather than be in a zoo? But I'm really not being funny about this. There is a Steadicam shot in this. If Martin Scorsese had done this shot, he would have been proud of it. He would have said, you know, all that nonsense at the beginning of Goodfellas, or that guy, you know, at the beginning of Boogie Nights, you know, that incredible Steadicam shot which goes in through a house and goes into a swimming pool and comes out and carries on. Nothing compared with the four-story fighting Steadicam shot in the middle of Warrior King, in which Tony Jaa goes looking for his elephant. I'm not saying it's got a great plot. I'm not saying it's got a great story. I'm just saying four stories of punch-ups in one take.
I mean, as far as lost elephant movies goes, it's up there.
Yeah, I'm trying to think of any other lost elephant movies. Is there a lost elephant in Born Free?
Almost certainly.
Well, it's better than that. It's got more punching for a start. But honestly, I really, really enjoyed
it. More punching than Born Free. That's the best poster line that we can think of. Is there anything else?
Moving swiftly on, Stay Alive. Yet another horror film based on a video game. It's a bunch of teenagers. One of them plays a video game, dies in the manner of the video game. The rest of them start playing the video game and, oh, things start happening in the manner of the video game. And then halfway through, they realise it's all based on Elspeth Bartery, of course, Countess Dracula, if you're familiar with the legend. That's it. I mean, it's the plot. You go, oh, it's a computer game. It's based on Elizabeth Bartery, Countess Dracula. Oh, a bunch of stuff happening. Oh, run around. Ooh, and then none of it makes any sense because the people that die come back. And
if
then
you hadn't known it was a computer game, you might have watched it with a slightly more open mind.
No, this is not true. I went into it with an open mind because it's a horror film. Right? It's a 15-rated horror film, but it's a horror film. And I think, fine, you know, you never know. And the story, which of course is The Ring anyway, because The Ring is, you watch the video game, you don't remember the first time you ever saw The Ring, Ringu actually, first time I saw Ringu rather than The Ring, which of course is the American remake, which is Pants. First time I saw Ringu, I think, God, that's really scary. Put the videotape in, you're going to die, you know, 7 days after watching it, because it has that urban mythology thing. Well, in this case, there is the potential for that kind of creepiness, urban myth. You play the game's bigger than you. I mean, it's like Tron anyway. I mean, all this stuff dates back to Tron has got an awful lot to answer for. The idea of people being in video games or the Lawnmower Man. Do you remember the Lawnmower Man, that Brett Lennon? Fine. All that stuff has a lot to answer for. In this, it's just they play the game. You go, fine, okay, it's going to be one of those. Every 10 minutes, funny death, funny death, funny death. Wolf Creek is apparently playing on the television very soon. I mean, I just don't understand why it is that the potential for making good scary movies is there, and yet this is what we get. It's rubbish. It's nonsense. It's boring. It's dreary. It adds nothing. I mean, Silent Hill is more interesting, because at least Silent Hill is directed by Christoph Gantz, and Christoph Gantz is actually a visual stylist. I mean, he can't tell a story to save his life. He's got absolutely no sense of narrative whatsoever, but you think the individual bits look good. But this, you sit there going, well, it doesn't even look good. It just looks like some naff old piece of, you know, rubbish that's not very scary. So, no good. Other two things which I'll do very quickly. Angel A and Renaissance. I'm going to mention these back to back. Renaissance is quite an interesting animation film that I think must be done on the basis of you do live action, then you turn it into animation, because it looks very, very photorealist, sort of live action. It's a futuristic setting, dystopian future story, very, very intense noir, black and white animation stylishness. Now, the narrative is a little bit all over the place, and the narrative is one of those classic dystopian future fantasies, which is not terrific. But from an animation point of view, it looks absolutely terrific, and although I got slightly bored by the length of it, and after about half an hour you think, yes, I really like the way it looks, but it needs to move forward a little bit more. And then in the last 40 minutes, it really picked itself up, and by the end of the film, I liked it more. I mentioned that back-to-back with Angel A, or Angela, depending on how you want to pronounce it, which is the new film by Luc Besson, which
it means completely different things.
Because this is a black-and-white style film made by Luc Besson. It's live action, but it's all to do with style. It's all black and white. It's all terribly sort of, oh, look at me, I'm very clever, I've made a black and white film. And the story is, you know, Wings of Desire, mm-hmm. which we really like. And of course, when I was out in Berlin, I went up the Angel of Victory monument.
You're very excited to be in Berlin, not for the World Cup, but because it was near the Wings of Desire statue.
Imagine that film remade, set in Paris, and rather than, you know, these great guardian angels played by these terrific actors, you have somebody who is dressed as, and I'm using her words, not mine, a blonde slut. And that's it. It's the Luc Besson movie with the short guy whose guardian angel turns out to be a blonde slut. And like all Luc Besson movies, you go, okay, is that it? Is that all there is? Oh, no, that is the film. It's a short guy and a tall blonde slut woman. And as I said, that's not my phrase. So please, you know, it's the word they use. And you think, why would anyone do that? You think, oh, I know why. Because you're Luc Besson.
But it's Angel A. That's what it is.
Angel
and
A.
Not Angela.
No, no,
so
but she, no, no, exactly. It is Angel
Richard
A.
Richard
III
becoming Richard Ill and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, Richard Ill. Richard Illin in the hood.
Movie of the week.
Warrior King.
Mark, thanks very much indeed. Thank you. Williams will be here on Monday. Have a good weekend. This is 5 Live, and Drive is next.